The next case is 95-1708, State of Ohio versus Neveter Triplets.
Was it very nice to have these people who are charged with crimes sit there and Counsel, the basis for arrest.
Counsel, does the state have any obligation to make sure that the defendant has been notified of these charges?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What's your obligation?
The obligation is that according to the criminal rules, simply to send out the complaint. And the summons and the first completely satisfy that requirement. We don't have a thousand, million, hundred thousand sheriffs and deputies running around to serve indictments. Indictments are now served by certified mail or by ordinary mail.
If it comes back and gives notice to the sending party that is unclaimed or refused, do they have any obligation to proceed further?
Well, not really. If you look at the rule, and that's the rule that I just quoted, that's Civil Rule 4.6b. If a certified mail envelope is returned with an endorsement showing that the envelope was unclaimed, then the clerk may send, by ordinary mail, a copy of the summons and complaint. Service shall be incomplete when the fact of mailing is entered of the record, provided that the ordinary mail envelope is not returned by postal authorities showing that there was no further address. So the state did act with reasonable diligence in this particular case. What I think where the Court of Appeals went wrong in this particular case in the trial court, nobody looked at the criminal rule that says that service is accomplished by resort to the civil rules. And the civil rule talks about that very situation. Did the state act with reasonable diligence in sending out the service? And the answer is correct. And I'm going to tie all this in for you, Judge Sweeney, with Judge Porter, Judge Nugent, and Judge Blackman's decision in State versus Stevens.
Does the state have any obligation to follow up on cases issued by the court?
I think the state has there's no case law that I know where the state has an opportunity, or the sheriff has an opportunity to run around. They can serve these cases if they acted in good faith. As you look at Doggett, I think Doggett answers that question. As you look to Doggett, Doggett separates the degree of prejudice that the state is either guilty of or not guilty. One of the tests is, was there diligent prosecution? And there was diligent prosecution in this particular case because we complied with certified mail, which she refused two times to pick it up. She called it unclaimed, Justice Griffin. And his opinion says there was a big distinction between unclaimed service and refusal to accept, because refusal to accept might connote, I don't know what kind of reasoning he had on that particular thing, that refusal to accept means that she knows something's coming in but she doesn't want to touch it, whereas unclaimed means that she just didn't claim it. So
well, unclaimed.
Yeah,
unclaimed could mean that the little slip that the post office leaves at your postal box got. She had, there were four children, I guess, in the house here. She lived with her mother, and that could have gotten misplaced, I suppose, whereas refused means, I think it means that you've actually been confronted with the postal person and you said, I'm not going to take that. That's a little different than unclaimed. It may not be legally different, but it is, there are different circumstances, it seems to me. Do we know on that point, do we know what, in the record, the significance of the failure of the clerk's office, the sheriff's office, to put the zip code on this mail is?
Actually, there's no relevance whatsoever.
We assume it got delivered even though
the mail would have come back, the ordinary mail would have come back indicating address unknown or no such address or anything else like that. And you can assume that from the fact, as did the dissenting judge, that she received the ordinary mail because later on there was a scam set up by the Attorney General at the time who notified all these KPIs, outstanding KPIs people, that they were entitled to money, and they sent a letter by ordinary mail at her last known address, the same address that she furnished in this office.
Came to get the money.
And she shows up at the hotel to claim her money. That's how she's arrested. So you just assume it. I even think Judge Griffin finally, he can get it right on the point. And I hate reading, but I've got to read Judge Newton's footnote. This factual finding in trial court's opinion in journal entry stands in contrast to the court's pronouncement from the bench that, quote, the defendant was notified that letter that was sent out by registered mail was just ignored. This is Judge Griffin saying that. And that the other letter came to the house telling her to come down to the court, and she didn't respond. Later, the court noted that some of the reasons for the delay are her fault, in my opinion. I'm satisfied here that the probabilities there that she got this first notice and ignored it. Later, the court clarified that it was prepared to accept that the appellant was notified by ordinary mail. I could find it somewhat implausible that appellee claimed that she did not receive summons and a copy of the indictment by certified and ordinary mail in light of her enthusiastic receipt of notice to the same address from the Attorney General's office.
Because we know who read it. Yeah. The docket case says that if the defendant has notice of the indictment, then if the defendant has the right, has the obligation to invoke, in this case, her speedy trial rights, the obligation shifts if you can show that the defendant had notice.
Oh, sure.
Now, that's, the, to me, a pretty critical point here that's raised by the footnote. It appears that the trial court's opinion says the defendant was unaware of the indictment, and yet it appears that the record says has different conclusions. Which, can we take any heed of what was said from the bench if the judgment says that she did not?
Yeah, that's the judge's words. I think you could take that from the bench, absolutely. Because Doggett, as you say, it has a critical aspect of it. But if you look at Doggett, Doggett is an 8.5 year post-indictment delay. The facts of Doggett are so different. When Souter writes the opinion, Justice Souter writes the opinion of Doggett.
But
got to be
in
Doggett,
I mean, he's sick with his point. In Doggett, it was determined that the defendant there did not have notice.
Correct.
Now,
stipulated by the government.
Right.
And
dissent
conceded by the government.
The dissent, of course, assumes that this defendant did, you know, sure ought to have known. But nevertheless, that they were saddled with the determination that the defendant did not know that there was, that he was under indictment. So the different result in Doggett might be explained if you can say here that we have a determination that this defendant knew she was under indictment, and therefore she has a duty to invoke her speedy trial right. But where are we on that?
We're on the fact that she did have notice. She had notice even the trial court admitted from the bench that she had notice on that particular point. And that's obvious because the ordinary mail never came back. And it's also obvious from the fact that the Attorney General sent her a letter, the same address that she furnished police, that letter came into being.
Doesn't the judgment of the trial judge turn on the decision that this defendant was unaware?
Yes, and it was an erroneous decision.
So finding the fact, though.
The finding of fact was erroneous.
But can we do anything about that?
Yes. Yes, the case that I wanted to cite, I'm glad you asked that question. It's the Manning case that I cited to you. In the Manning case, they state very, very clearly, and so does too, that the ruling of Defendant Sixth Amendment's speedy trial claims is reviewed de novo. Not only is that the standard in this particular case, it's also the particular case of the ruling of the holding of the case in the United States versus Sandoval, which is also cited in my brief. So you have a right, just like you do in a capital case, the one I just argued, that you review it completely. You know,
okay, if we do that, is there any evidence through her testimony or the testimony of others that she actually received it? I mean, what is the evidence? Is it limited?
The evidence is you go to the Rule 4-6, certified mail was sent, but she refuses to claim it two times by the postal authorities and county server. Then the clerk sends out by ordinary mail. She got that ordinary mail. The service is complete unless the ordinary mail is returned to the office saying address unknown or wrong address. So she got it. She got the notice. I'd like to save the 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
That's
going on. It's such a significant case. I may ask this court for an additional few minutes to argue on the rebuttal portion because I have not even begun to begin the analysis on the Barker factors, which I think are critical. And I think I can save this court a lot of time because Doggett is such a convoluted decision. I have to explain it to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Seth. Mr. Green.
People in this country certain rights. The Sixth Amendment is that Bill of Rights, amendment to our Constitution, gives the criminally accused certain rights, jury trial, lawyer. And I think it's important if we just look at the Sixth Amendment, exactly what it says, where it starts out. It says, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy trial. So that is clear in its meaning. It doesn't say all those imprisoned waiting trial have a speedy trial. All those accused, all criminal prosecution, which this was, the accused, the Strickland is, has the right, shall enjoy the right to a speedy trial.
But you would agree that she can waive that?
Yes.
Okay, and wouldn't ducking or refusing to respond to a court order constitute such a waiver?
Yes. Well, I'm just for the analysis, I'm saying first you've got to determine whether this was a speedy trial or not. I think 4 years, or more than 4 years, 53 months, makes it not a speedy trial. By the analysis in Doggett saying a year, presumptively, and this is four times that amount. So I think you have to say, did she get a speedy trial? And I think it's clear that she didn't. So the issue is why.
How do you, yes, okay, you're going to go on with what I was going to ask about, because how do you explain this, justify the unclaimed, and does she have any responsibility in that area?
Judge found, in his opinion, there's no evidence that she refused service. It went unclaimed. Is it unusual mail delivered to the wrong place? I don't know anything about where this was delivered to, how many addresses there are, what section of town it's in, because there's one thing, there's no zip code, which point out is showing a copy of, putting a copy of.
But can't we presume that it came to her address in view of the fact that this sting letter was received by her and she responded to it? Don't we have to take that into consideration?
I don't think you can presume she got it. It went unclaimed, showing that she probably didn't know it existed. She didn't know what this was going to be.
No,
I mean, she was released straight away.
In the law, we have the function of presumption that mail that's properly put in the post box is received. We do that all the time. That's the basis of Rule 46D, right? When it's not returned, that means it was delivered.
Or delivered to the wrong address.
The presumption that it goes to the right address.
We wouldn't want to presume it goes to the wrong address.
How was your client prejudiced by the delay?
The court in Boston said there's a presumption of prejudice after 1 year due to the natural inability to recall events as they occur as time passes. So it says we can presume there's a prejudice after a year and it intensifies over time.
I'm assuming then that since you haven't told me any of it, there was none specifically stated that she was prejudiced.
There was there's no
evidence. With the presumption in Doggett, but there is nothing that you can articulate at this point that would prejudice her actually.
I don't think the judge took evidence on that matter.
Should he have?
I think he should have. I think there's clearly ways to show it probably would have been a problem. There's three other people in that hotel room when the arrest occurred. I'm not sure how easy it would be to locate them at this juncture.
So other than the presumption, there is none for the record?
There's none for the record other than under the dog analysis that he took this fall. What's the state's obligation to do something? The state has to do anything. In Doggett case, the government made an attempt. They went to his house. They determined he was out of the country. They investigated in that country what happened. They found out they heard he was in Colombia. They checked the Colombian authorities. They found out he was in jail in Panama. They couldn't do anything. They asked to be notified of his return, or when he's released, they have him turned over to them. That wasn't done. So they made that type of effort. And then 2 years later, he comes back in the country openly and goes about about building up his life in the married Christian school. Then they make a routine check, and they say, inaugurally, they said that that violated his speedy trial rights. States made no effort close to what they made in Doggy, sending anybody to his address, checking with authorities to see if he's incarcerated or wherever. There's no follow-up.
To what extent, Mr. Green, should we be weighing the difficulty of government agencies to cause people who should be in court to come to court against the right of the defendant to not offer themselves to, or the, I don't know if I say it's a right or not, but certainly the inclination of defendants to not offer themselves up for prosecution if they don't have adequate notice. Isn't there what's happened here is, it appears that what's happened here is that there are a vast number of persons such as your client who are so-called low-level drug offenders for whom the county offices have to create some kind of mechanism to get them to come to court because many won't come. And do you have any thoughts about how we balance those two interests? Do we just say, well, whatever it takes, whatever the cost is, they have to go out to everybody's home with a capias and say, you know, you're coming to court? Or is it sufficient to have to presume that if we mail them two or three notices, that they're on notice, and then they presume to waive their speedy trial rights?
Well, I think in what the courts have said, what Dawson said, the government has to be something. I mean, here are excuses. We sent a letter, telling them we don't got time.
Well, they sent three letters, and then two or three, was it?
Two. And other than that, we don't got time. We don't got time to go out here, see if they live there. We don't got time to go pick them up. You just don't have the manpower of the time. In Doggett, the court said that the government cannot complain too mildly when their actions show an incompetently feeble interest in bringing the accused to justice. I think that's a great point.
So they
have this interest in going out here.
So the
low-level drug case, we don't got time for that. We had much bigger cases to bring forward. We'll get it when we get it. This wasn't even, I mean, if you look through the record, you see they didn't even have a case. This wasn't even an issue. The police would have stopped her for some reason. Women showed up on their computer. She was in a status that they call, from their records, that's called limbo.
Limbo.
Yeah, she was in limbo. And the Sixth Amendment, I think part of its purpose is to keep people out of limbo. So they don't be in limbo for 4, 5, 6 years, waiting for the government to get time to bring forward their case.
So you would argue that Doggett instructs government that it has to do whatever it costs, whatever the personnel, whatever the cost is, that they have to make a greater attempt than simply sending mail to someone's address.
Right. Other courts published cases in other counties. I think it's Looper, but I'm not sure. It's inside the brief, in which they made two attempts. They went to the sheriff, went to the guy's house, and he just wasn't home. They said that wasn't enough. So sending a letter, which came back to the claim, which gives the other side some notice, this person may not know about it. We can't show they know about it. The judge probably knows.
Isn't that the different factor? Where those are, I think that those cases are speaking about effort that must be applied so that the defendant knows about it. Now, if you have a situation where the defendant knows about it, then doesn't the law doesn't say then, or doesn't speak to, that you have to go further and have a habeas. I think the whole goal here is to see that the defendant knows about it, and then, you know, if I'm reading Doggett right, it shifts back to the accused to invoke their own speedy trial rights. So all of this, you know, if you haven't told them, then we're going to look at prejudice and whether or not there's enough diligence. Do you agree?
Correct. It's certainly said. You still have a speedy trial right. You don't have to jump up and down and say, I want a speedy trial. You have to make a court appearance. If they don't bring it, even if you know you have a
one and say I want to speak to Trump?
Well,
otherwise, you're just talking about
gamesmanship,
aren't you? But,
right.
I mean, it is the right of the accused. It's not a burden on the state as much as it was always intended to be a right of the accused.
Right. I mean, at the initial stage, you don't have to invoke it. You can invoke it when it comes later. There's things not a waiver, not saying you didn't complain about it 4 months ago.
Yeah, I know you're talking about waiver once you're right.
Right.
But in this case...
But it has to be raised. And that comes around to the last proposition of law, how it was raised here. I'm not sure what the state is proposing here, what's the... what remedy they want, saying Judge Griffin improperly raised this issue. Is our position that the plea waives this constitutional issue? The defendants are entitled to know that they're waiving important constitutional issues at a plea. Judge Griffin informed the parties that appears to be an issue here. And were they waiving it or were they going to invoke it? I don't see nothing improper in that. Another thing I'd like to point out is pointed out to me on a lot of occasions, there's no objection by the state at the time. That issue is, from the defense point of view, if there's something objectionable on the record that's not rejected, it generally is waived. The prosecutor was there. He made no objection at the time. He's entitled to object. He's entitled to set a record why, what the objection is, and what grounds for it. But he made no effort at that point. So I don't see any error on the part of Judge Griffin in informing someone about the plea of their constitutional right to a speedy trial. There's case laws presented here that says he doesn't necessarily have to go into the speedy trial right as part of Rule 11, and maybe he doesn't, but I don't see anywhere where he says he cannot.
Let me take you back to a technical issue, and maybe I'm incorrect in my recollection. They sent certified mail, came back, there were two attempts to deliver, or two notices, I guess, left at the box that you've got a certified letter down at the post office, and nobody came in and picked up the certified letter. Doesn't the civil rule then require ordinary mail follow-up, or am I wrong in that regard?
I guess the civil rules for their service does.
Okay. And was that done here? Was there any evidence that that was done here?
I think there's testimony that something similar to what he said was put in there, but it's some type of different document or whatever than what originally was said. I don't think they actually put the indictments in it.
But some notice that you are commanded to appear at the courthouse to respond. Something was sent by ordinary mail.
Something was sent. Was testimony. I would just like to conclude that Doggett is a case that should be followed in case it's the rule of land. There's other opinions that are good opinions about what should be done, but they are in the set. Doggett's rule of land. Doggett enforces the Sixth Amendment thing, which says, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy trial. And in this case, she did not given that right. There's no evidence that she was at fault by the findings of the trial judge, and the state did little, nothing to try to bring her to court any sooner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Saad, you saved a little over a minute of your time.
We have a brief extension on that.
Well, let's just start. Just start and see if there are any questions from the court.
Yeah,
if not,
I just want to say Doggett does not apply. Doggett is where the government conceded that the defendant did not know about the presence of the indictment. So Doggett is not even applicable. The cases that are totally applicable are the two cases that have not been in the brief, and that's one used, U.S. versus Manning, which I cited earlier, and the whole thing is if the delay can be attributed to the defendant himself, he will be deemed to have waived his speedy trial rights entirely. That's Manning and that's Sandoval. Those, that is the argument, the crux of the state's case. Service was perfected, was not, the certified mail was unclaimed, the ordinary mail was received by her, so she had notification of her arraignment, and she had notification of her indictment, and she refused to accept it. So therefore, you follow the logic of Manning, and it says if a delay can be attributed to the defendant, he will be deemed to have waived his speedy rights entirely. That's the holding of Manning, and that's the proposition that the state seeks to impress upon the court.
Now, in this case, then, after the letter was unclaimed, it was resent by ordinary mail.
Correct. And then under 460, that's perfect service. That's how you do service in every case. You ever complain to the state. And secondly, the opinion of Porter, Nugent, and Blackman. Let me read you that. The dogged extraordinary delay between indictment and arrest was approximately 104 months. That's 8.5 years. Secondly, they said, in contrast to dogged, we believe the present 66-month delay cannot be said to be extraordinary. Therefore, we reject the logic that Looper refused to weigh the time period between indictment and arrest under Collins' claim for speedy trial. This unreported opinion should have been cited by the appellate court and should have been cited by the dissenting judge, but for some unknown reason they forgot about State versus Stevens, which totally
Counsel, let me
demolishes.
Because this is an important issue, let me change the facts on you a little bit. Let's say that at this hearing before the judge on the defendant takes a stand and said, yeah, Judge, you know, I had a bunch of bill collectors chasing me and I didn't, every time one of these things came, I thought somebody else was suing me and I didn't respond to any of those. But I never saw that ordinary mail thing. I don't know whether my kids threw it away or I just never saw it. I didn't know. So you've got some direct testimony. She didn't know. And then well, you could deal with that one maybe. But then let me add some more facts to it. And then there's testimony that the critical witnesses to her defense of I didn't do it are dead or gone. That the passage of time has now made it much more difficult to defend. Should you weigh that into it?
Well, absolutely. The balancing test is a marker, Justice Spiker. The balancing test is the reason for the length of the delay, the assertion of the rights. She did not assert her rights. She stood in front of Judge Griffin and was ready to plead guilty until Judge Griffin gets up and says, well, I think you have a speedy trial problem here, and let's just take a look at it. That part, the Court of Appeals told you was Fred Doggett. Doggett says that when you take the balancing test, is the defendant more to blame than the state? And if the defendant is more to blame than the state, then the defendant must show actual prejudice, as Justice Sweeney has noted, and this defendant could not show any prejudice whatsoever from her denial. She suffered no imprisonment, she suffered no public outlay, she suffered no anxiety, she went around her merry business, and if we take your logic to the extreme, anybody who gets a complaint, no matter be a divorce case or any type of criminal action, all they have to do is say, I never received the mail, so therefore I am absolved from all sin whatsoever. And it is the balancing factors. If you look at Justice Nugent's dissent and you look at the four factors and how he analyzes them and urging reversal, I think that is a tremendous guide. I know you did that in State versus just give me a moment to let my thoughts. The recent case that I came down here and actually
Well, we'll find it.
Yeah,
we'll find it. Your red light's been on for some time, Mr. Sowell.
And you look at that, and balance all I'm just responding to Justice Breckinridge.
Yeah, I know.
And if you look at all those four factors, and you'll come to the common sense conclusion that this lady was notified, and she waived her rights to a speedy trial, it couldn't be any easier. That's the analysis, and that's the crux of my entire proposition. Number one, it's a critical case because of the implications and the messages that are going to be sent from this court. You can review this case completely de novo like a capital case, but no fear of any deferential findings or anything else, and come to a common sense conclusion that she had a copy of her summons to appear, and she waived it, and that is as simple as that, and she could not demonstrate any actual prejudice whatsoever from this.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton.
I thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.